something.
For news you need to know, listen to Off the Hour, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. From Montreal, across Canada, and around the world, we have it all. Hard-hitting reports, eyewitness interviews, and in-depth documentaries exploring the issues without the corporate spin doctoring.
You know, there are two ways to go through life. One is to believe everything. The other is to believe nothing. Both ways avoid thinking.
Catch the news on Off the Hour, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM.
It's just past 5 on Tuesday, November 21st, and you are listening to our local journalism initiative roundup on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal, and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm your host, Jules Bijal, and I am also your local journalist at the station, covering the issues that matter to you, whether that's protests or, well, it's been a lot of protests lately, and today is no exception. I was on multiple picket lines to speak to workers who are striking as part of the Common Front. The Common Front represents around 420,000 workers in the province, and they're undertaking a three-day strike. You're going to hear all about that on today's show, as well as a story about Montreal's municipal budget that included hikes for property taxes that I'm sure most homeowners know about, but you know, it's going to hit us renters too. So lots to learn about there, as well as hikes to transit spending and no surprise, police spending yet again in Montreal. We've also got a story about a new union that's happening right in our backyard at Drawn and Quarterly in Montreal's Mile End, both the publisher and the two bookstores. We've got a couple interviews on the show as well about the Mohawk mothers who've just won a court case yesterday that will reinstate an expert panel to survey the search done for human remains at the Royal Victoria Hospital site while drilling and excavation work takes place. We've also got an interview with someone from Independent Jewish Voices Montreal. We talk about the way in which solidarity for Palestinian and Jewish peoples can be affected in our movements in Montreal, as well as the ongoing campaign to force Montreal's anti-racism commissioner Boshra Manai to resign. So that's going to be our show today. Hope you tune in. And as always, you can reach me at jules@ckut.ca. And you can find all these stories online at ckut.ca/LJI. Now, here's our program.
Looking to spice up your life and bring more flavor to your food? Try Mr. Boom, famous jerk dressing and pepper sauce. It's that good.
Common Front workers are back on the picket line today. The coalition, representing 420,000 public and parapublic workers, is on strike until Thursday. Their demands include better working conditions and a salary that rises with inflation. Between this and the two-day nurses' strike on Wednesday and Thursday, Montrealers can expect disruptions when accessing healthcare. But the main disruption is in education. Teachers in the English school boards and both school and Cégep support staff are part of the Common Front. Teachers in the Centre de Service Scolaire de Montréal, which is the city's largest French language school service center, will go on indefinite strike starting Thursday.
It is our last resort to strike. And it's really hard for us to know, to disrupt people's lives like this. But we feel at this moment that we have no choice.
Speaking now is Andrea DiTommaso, representing the English school support staff in the CSN. She spoke to me outside École Spécialisée Irénée Lucier in Hochelaga, braving the cold alongside many of the workers from the school.
Support staff are the foundations of our education system. Without a foundation, the whole building's going to crumble.
Despite their importance, she says support staff are at the bottom of the ladder when it comes to compensation, which has ripple effects throughout our schools.
We are here representing the support staff, which are the lowest paid out of all the provincial public servants, which means, like, you know, including municipal and federal. Like, our average salary is $24,400 a year because most of us are part-time. And most of us are laid off during the summer. So that really makes it difficult for people to make a living. So we're here for that, and we're here for working conditions. So far, things for years have been declining. People have been leaving in droves.
The main problem that I see in that school is that we are understaffed and from a lot. We have a lot of people that are not replaced, and therefore there's a lack of service for the kids who come here. If we were fully staffed, we wouldn't have to compromise our health and our mental health, physical health, to make sure that everybody is safe.
Francis Nadeau-Lannoy has a tough job at Ironie Lucie, where the special needs students sometimes need physical intervention. His job only gets harder as more and more workers leave the sector.
A typical day for me is not typical because every day is different in the sense that when I don't know when or who's going to call me for help. I usually respond to calls that implies that I need to intervene with kids that have problems or with classes that have difficulties to handle the situation, either if it's an aggressive situation or just in prevention. Every day is not the same. In a sense, that's cool because, you know, I don't know how my day is going to be. I know when my day is going to start. I don't know when it's going to end. So I'm not in a routine loop. But in another sense, I don't know if I'll come back home that night or I'll end up in the hospital.
It's not just support staff. According to Stephen Lesser, teachers are also facing tough conditions for less pay. Lesser is the president of the Quebec Provincial Association of Teachers, representing around 8,000 teachers in English school boards. He says it's been a year now that educators have tried to move the needle at the bargaining table, but there's been no progress.
We're here at this conjuncture of 3 days of strike because it's not moving at the tables. It's been over a year. Sonia Lebel asked us to recenter our demands, which we did, and which she isn't acknowledging. She keeps saying that she's waiting for a counteroffer, which, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of most of our union leaders, she's received.
He says teachers' demands are a mix of structural issues within schools and better pay across the board to address the massive teacher shortage that Quebec saw going into this fall term. That shortage was so bad that Education Minister Bernard Drainville said that, at the end, it didn't matter if the teacher was qualified or even had a college degree. Schools could hire any high school grad who could fill a seat and watch some kids.
I sound like a broken record. This is what I've been saying all the time. Workload, it's the composition of the class. It's the lack of support for our special needs and at-risk children. And, of course, remuneration. I mean, I'd be lying if it wasn't about some money. And the teachers in the entry level, our first-year teachers, are the lowest paid across Canada. And that does not make it very attractive for recruitment and retention. We're in a shortage, and this is the opportunity for our government to make some moves. It's not an overnight thing. We all know that. It's going to take time, but you got to take that first step, and they're not willing.
Lesser is grateful for the support he's seen so far from the parents in Quebec. He hopes they know that the students' success is tied to that of the teachers.
You know, a lot of our demands are to help their children be successful. It's not just about money for the teachers. It's about working conditions. And in turn, I mean, it definitely goes hand in hand with student success.
So like today, it's like the kids are happy and they're like, it's like the weekend started early, you know, like, and I'm not stressed out yet. I'm fine.
This is Caroline Kunsley, a Montreal parent who's in support of the strikes. She was in good spirits when I spoke with her on Tuesday, saying she's been able to arrange childcare for the rest of the week.
We had some time to organize, so I'm actually fine because I have friends that are parents that live in the neighborhood, so I coordinated with a couple of them to sort of do shifts. So today, my kid is over at a friend's house with her kids. On Thursday, they're going to come over here. Tomorrow, I have another neighbor's kid coming over. You know, we're doing that kind of thing. I work from home, and I have flexibility.
But even if things get tough, she says her support for public workers is unwavering, especially the teachers and support staff who care for her son.
I fully 100% support what they're doing. And I think it's essential because the system is so broken and has been for a long time. And the government needs to step up and invest in education and all the other things. But, you know, when I'll speak from the point of view of a parent and supporting the teachers and the support staff at the schools. They have such a hard job. They have such an important job. Like, my kid's teacher sees my kid more hours in a week than I do, right? Or collectively, all the teachers at the school. I send him there at 8 in the morning, and I pick him up maybe at 3:30 or maybe at 5. You know, these are the people that are making sure my kid, not just teaching them, like, math and reading and all of those things, but just making sure that they're okay, making sure that they're in a safe place, making sure that they're eating, you know, that they get fresh air, that, you know, socially nothing bad is going on, making sure they're not being bullied, in addition to teaching them how to read and write and solve problems and interact. And, you know, just there's just so much. I could go on and on.
She says she's not angry with teachers or other public workers, but she is angry at the politicians in Quebec City who've allowed things to get to this point.
They don't care about regular people. These are people who have a lot of money, who've probably sent all their kids to private school, who support, you know, the direction we're going, which is towards more and more privatized systems. They don't care about they don't care about us. They only will care if they feel like they're not going to get reelected, if they're in trouble because what they're doing is too unpopular. They have some kind of popular base of support, clearly, because they got elected. But this might change it. I certainly hope so, because they don't, like, why haven't they invested? Because they think they can get away with it. Why is everything happening that's happening? Why are rents going up so high? Why is everything so expensive? Because the people who have the power to change that think they can get away with it.
That's why Quinsley says we shouldn't just tolerate the striking workers. We should celebrate them and the fight they're undertaking for public services that are going to benefit all Quebecers.
They need to do this. They need to inconvenience, you know, general society so that the government gets feedback from the public at large saying, like, you know, do your job.
The Common Front strikes will continue tomorrow and Thursday, and they'll be joined by nurses' strikes as well. On Thursday at 11, teachers with the FAE are kicking off their indefinite strike at Jerry Park, and you can join their march downtown from there. The City of Montreal tabled its 2024 budget on Wednesday, clocking in at just under $7 billion. That number represents a 3.6% increase from 2023, which officials stress is under the rate of inflation. Despite high inflation, the city's aiming to keep spending low without cutting services.
Le budget qu'on vous présente aujourd'hui, ben, il est responsable. C'est le mot qui me vient en tête. C'est le mot, en fait, qui nous a conduit tout au long de nos travaux de la dernière année.
Whether or not that will make property owners happy is another story. Residential property taxes are seeing an almost 5% hike, with variation depending on your borough. But a 32% jump in property valuations between 2022 and 2023 mean that this year's increases will be keenly felt. And if history is any indication, landlords will pass on those increases to tenants.
The expenses of the city are going to rise, of course, but it's quite from only 3.5%. So this is why it's connected to the raise of the 4.9 taxes. And for me, it's about protecting all the services, because this is something that all Montrealers have asked us. It's very important to them, and we agree this is part of the fundamental mission of a city, to make sure that arenas are open, libraries, that, you know, snow removal continues, all these things that people are attached to.
The tax hike represents a major change for Plante. She's long called dependence on property taxes outdated and has campaigned for a more diverse set of revenue-raising tools. She echoed that at Wednesday's press conference, saying that the tax hike was an unfortunate necessity. Plante added that she's waiting on provincial developments that would give cities like Montreal new revenue-raising powers.
For that to happen, there has to be regulation and some laws being tabled by the government of Quebec, because, as you know, we are under, in some areas, when it comes to fiscality, we are closely connected to the government of Quebec. Now, with the Minister Laforêt, I have just tabled a projet de loi, a bill, that will give us some tools. But we're always, but we need to analyze this projet de loi, this bill. We need to look at what will be possible. But of course, this is what we are looking for.
Of the extra $235 million the city's spending this year, the biggest element of that is going to the ARTM, which will table its own budget in the coming days. That $48.4 million represents a roughly 7% increase in transit spending from 2023 for the Public Transit Authority for Greater Montreal. Those extra funds couldn't come at a better time. Last month, transit agencies sounded the alarm about a projected $2.5 billion deficit over the next 5 years. The province is only covering around 70% of next year's deficit, with the 4 years after that left up in the air. But transit financing researcher Lancelot Rodrigue says the city's funding likely won't make much of a dent in the deficit, with most of the extra funds going toward free Opus fares for seniors.
The core of that, which is about 36 million, so 75% of it, is for the free fare for older adults. So these funds will not necessarily go into reducing current deficit that the ARTM has, because they're already for another measure. They come from the city budget going to cover the loss fare revenue that would be from this measure.
Even if the city knew about the budget deficit, they wouldn't have had enough time after negotiations with the province concluded to make any meaningful investments to financing the sector. Public transit leaders, for their part, are saying they're going to do their best not to cut service.
Of course, they knew there was a shortfall. Like, negotiation and talks started back last summer. But the main thing is that the main element was like, we know there's going to be a shortfall, but no one wanted necessarily to be the one to cover it. So the responsibility of who's going to cover it to what extent came very late.
After transit, it was policing that got the biggest bump, a $35.5 million increase. Part of that funding will go towards raises, and another big chunk will help the SPVM hire 225 new officers by the end of the year. The city says they need more police to implement Vision Zero, with greater traffic enforcement in school zones. Another big reason to hire more cops, they say, is to cut down on overtime pay, a long-standing issue in the force that puts a strain on municipal budgets. Security accounts for almost 20% of municipal spending in Montreal.
Since 2020, the Projet Montréal government has increased the police budget by more than any other large city in Canada.
For Dr. Ted Rutland, an associate professor at Concordia University studying policing in Montreal, this year's increase is a case of déjà vu.
Well, they increased the budget by $65 million last year in order to hire 150 more police officers. The police didn't hire 150 more police officers. They spent all their money anyway, and they went over their budget by $47 million. So, you know, someone might want to explain how we gave them $65 million to hire more cops. They didn't do it. They used the money anyway, and then went over their budget by $47 million. So now this year, we're told we need to give them $35 million so they can hire more cops. You know what's going to happen is they're not going to hire them. They're going to spend all that money, and they're going to go over their budget again. The Montreal police go over their budget by an average of $35 million a year, every year. So they basically give themselves their own budget. They're the only police force in Canada that does this. The closest comparable to Montreal is Vancouver, which goes over its budget by an average of $2 million a year.
This may be unusual in Canada, but it's not in Montreal. The Projet Montréal government has increased police budgets far outside of the national average for every year since 2020, when Black Lives Matter protests changed the way most Canadians think about policing.
You know, it's useful to think about these budget increases in relation to 2020, because that was the moment of the second wave of the Black Lives Matter movement. It was a time where defunding the police, reinvesting in communities, and reimagining public safety was on everyone's lips, where a majority of Canadians supported defunding the police, and where defunding the police came to be synonymous with Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, if we want to look at the record of Projet Montréal since 2020, it's not hard to conclude that Black lives don't matter.
The big news this week, of course, has been the resignation of Dominique Olivier, the president of Montreal's executive committee. Olivier came under fire last week following a Journal de Montréal investigation, which showed that she spent taxpayers' dollars on lavish dinners and travel while head of the city's public consultation office, the OCPM. Mayor Plante started the press conference acknowledging the work that Olivier has done towards the budget. That work will now be undertaken by Luc Rabouin, borough mayor of the Plateau Montréal.
Je pense que c'est pas un secret, n'est-ce pas, suite à la démission de Dominique Olivier lundi après-midi. Ben, vous vous imaginez bien que c'est une semaine qui est exigeante. C'est évident. Mais je tiens d'ailleurs à remercier Madame Olivier pour le travail qu'elle a fait dans ce budget-là.
While the mayor has expressed confidence in Olivier, her swift resignation likely reflects the timing of this scandal, when tax increases will force Montrealers to tighten their belts.
Hey, yo, what's up? This is Usher chilling on CKUT, 90.3 FM, baby. Out.
Drawn and quarterly workers are turning over a new leaf. Last week, staff at the renowned comics publisher and pair of Myland bookstores announced they've unionized with the Fédération du Commerce of the CSN. I spoke with D&Q bookseller and union member Bridget Mountford to learn more about this new chapter for the Montreal Literary Mainstay. Here's our conversation. Yeah, I guess first, what started those conversations? What was it that brought employees together and say, you know, maybe a union's not such a bad idea?
Yeah, I would just start by saying that I'm very, very appreciative to work with the people I work with, because I think we just have ongoing conversations about what happens in the world, like that affects the kind of books that we're bringing in, that affects the sort of work we're doing. It's like a weird mix of commerce, but also arts and culture. And I'm lucky to work with people that are really proactive and engaged and not apathetic about their jobs. So I think it was just kind of, it was something that we talk about in passing. And it was something that we felt like, if we all want this, there doesn't need to be an inciting incident. It can just be something that comes about, and it's something that we see as being strengthening to our employment and strengthening, hopefully, to the bookstore, which we really do love, and the publisher itself, which we also really, really love. So I guess it was just kind of a moment of solidarity and a desire to have an active role in kind of discussing what our conditions look like, what our futures at the company look like. So yeah, it was kind of an organic thing.
Yeah. Can you tell me more, I guess, about conditions or what the future at the company looks like as of now? You know, you're just coming into having a union. You know, is it something that, I guess you could easily explain in terms of, you know, here is an incident where I thought, maybe there's something a little bit more. I want a proactive role so that X or Y does happen in the future, or, you know, A and B don't happen again. Is there anything like that?
I think I hesitate to speak for all of us as a collective, because I think we all have different experiences within the company. But I know for myself, enjoying the work I'm doing and wanting to feel like there is a path towards promotion or towards kind of a more, I don't know, involved position, because I think we are lucky to gain a lot of skills on the job, and just being able to collaboratively work on frameworks for advancement and for different compensation models, that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that we want to do in collaboration with the workers on the publishing side. So it's about kind of creating those communication channels. I'm sorry that I don't have anything more specific, but it's just kind of, that's always been my thought in any job I'm in, that I would love to be a part of the process. And I think unionization has a long history of doing just that, of giving workers a kind of a venue in which to discuss things with their employers, where they kind of have the collective and, I don't know, just a seat at the table.
I'm actually really curious about the links between publishing staff and the booksellers like yourself. You know, was this something that these links were strengthened during the unionization process? You said maybe that unionization is something so that you could have more communication in the future. Like, even on a very kind of granular level of like union cards, things like that. How did that, I guess, collaboration or solidarity actualize over the process?
I think we had different conversations in person, through chats online, that kind of thing. And I think it would maybe surprise people how much our roles overlap, because the bookstores were founded by the publishing company. We have the same management team. We have just a lot of the same interests. And one of our bookstores houses all the kind of back catalog of the publisher. We host all the events, or a large number of events rather, for Drawn and Quarterly authors that are based in Montreal or making a stop on their book tour. I think the values of the company, as set forth by the founders, the owners, all of that, are in effect at both stores, and so are kind of like we all have different roles and different contributions within the bookstore itself, within the publisher itself, but we're all ultimately part of the same company. And I think we're open to a collective bargaining process that results in different contracts for different roles. Like, that just seems like it makes sense. But just being able to work together because we're such a small company is something that I think will be really something that we were all on board with.
So what was the actual process like? You know, things like how much support was there, or was there a real effort to try and rally the employees at D&Q? Was there any conversation with management? How did you choose the CSN to become a part of? Like, you know, how did that all sort of go down?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all had different concerns. We, again, just I'm lucky to work with a bunch of people that I think were all open to the idea of unionization, had all either belonged to unions before in previous jobs, or were aware of the benefits of having representation at your workplace. So we had conversations about different unions. We know that the Indigo downtown Montreal had unionized with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, I believe. And we wanted to try and find a fit that balanced the kind of the space that our bookstore had as both like a retail space and a kind of a commercial enterprise in terms of publishing, that those are connected, and our desire to kind of envision a future that reflects the structure of our company. So we did our research. I think quite a few of us have friends that were students that belong to CSN unions. I know today that Concordia has officially unionized with the CSN, which is excellent news. And they just seem to be a really progressive trade union with a long history in this province, that were willing to collaborate with us, especially as a primarily English language publisher and bookstore. And again, that's not to say I don't have colleagues that are bilingual or francophone, but we just wanted to join a union that we felt aligned with our values. So we did research, but it kind of seemed like the obvious choice.
You mentioned Indigo, but there's also a broader, I think, moment or movement of unionization in the arts and for arts workers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How do you see what's happening at D&Q in I guess that larger context right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an exciting moment. There are economic stressors for people across industries, people that are working retail jobs, people that are working in arts and culture. We happen to be both. And there's also people that belong to unions that's working life has very little in common with mine. And that's still a source, I think, of inspiration and hope for a lot of us to just kind of, I guess, become kind of engaged in what our employment looks like and what our kind of our careers might look like. So it's definitely an inspiring and an exciting moment. I think it's born in a lot of ways from inflation and what seems to be a recession. And that's definitely a factor for all of us in terms of what jobs we seek, what kind of engagement we have at our jobs. And I think it can also be a really positive thing when employees are ready and willing to invest in staying in a role and invest in making it something that is sustainable for them in the long term.
If we could just look ahead to, you know, collective bargaining, right? Talking to the employer, talking to management. Can you tell me anything about when that process would start, what it might look like, if you've had any conversations with management? Give me just a window into what's up next for the new D&Q union.
course. Well, we've yet to have our General Assembly, so we haven't selected delegates yet, which will be an important part of the process so that we can have our democratically elected kind of representatives go forward through the collective bargaining process. So there's a lot more ahead of us, but we've been very happy at the support we've gotten from our larger community. And it's hard to say what the next few steps will be. I know our employers have been compliant and have done everything that's been asked of them, which we very much appreciate. But we don't know what the future holds, but we're hopeful, I think.
Yeah, they've done everything and they haven't engaged in union busting is what you're saying, because this is always the
of course,
city underbelly
yeah.
of the unionization efforts is like, you know, even to just not disrupt can be positive, unfortunately, given the track record of management in these cases.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe so. I think we're both engaging in good faith. And I'm hopeful at this time. I don't know what the future holds, but I think the culture that exists at the workplace wouldn't exist without people in management that care about their employees. And in lots of ways, a good company culture seems just as likely to produce a union as a bad company culture, because it allows for really wonderful, intelligent, thoughtful people to have conversations about what their long-term commitment is to one another and to the work they do.
That was my interview with Drawn & Quarterly bookseller and new union member Bridget Mounford. And we are just coming on halfway through the program. This is our local journalism initiative roundup, where I share stories that I've been working on at the station, funded by the Local Journalism Initiative, which is a program supported by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. As always, if you've got a story that you think that I should cover, send me an email. I'm jules@ckut.ca. Up next, you'll hear from Sarah Boivin of Independent Jewish Voices Montreal. We speak about the rising tensions that have happened in the city recently, as well as a campaign against Montreal's anti-racism commissioner, Bosch Lemonnet. Here's that conversation.
My name is Sarah Boivin, and I am part of the Montreal chapter of Independent Jewish Voices Canada. We are a national organization of Jewish people and allies working in solidarity with Palestinians.
Yeah, so maybe we can start at your recent piece in Le Devoir. Can you just tell me about the message? That piece was published in French. We have more of an Anglophone audience. What was the message behind that piece, and who were you responding to?
Absolutely. We were responding, I would say, primarily to recent moves from Jewish institutions that have been picked up by Quebecois politicians to really use recent anti-Semitic attacks as opportunities to divide our communities. So we're seeing these attacks become reasons, become justifications for not talking about Gaza, justifications for seeing pro-Palestinian gatherings and demos and marches be seen as themselves stirring up anti-Semitic hate, and all of these kinds of connections that are really just not justifiable. There isn't evidence behind them, and they are, as I said, causing division in the community. So as a coordinating committee for the local chapter, we wanted to put out a very clear message that we will not allow attacks on Muslim and Jewish communities to divide our communities or keep us afraid, and that we must keep our focus on Gaza as we fight anti-Semitism, because it is the people of Gaza right now who are facing a dehumanization that is being used to justify mass murder.
So we saw an attack on a mosque in Toronto, I believe yesterday, very recently. We've also seen attacks on Jewish schools and congregation buildings in Montreal in the past weeks. You know, somebody like MP Anthony Housefather, who's a politician based in Montreal, people from groups like CEJA have made the link between pro-Palestine protests and the violence at Jewish schools and institutions, but they're not making the link in the reverse, right? They're not saying that there is incitement among pro-Israel demonstrations or among the words from Israel's politicians that causes these incidents of hate. Do you think that that's just partisan interest, or is there something more to it? Why is it that pro-Palestine actions have this connotation of being incitements to hate and violence?
I think that actually ties in really well to another aspect of our piece in Le Devoir, which was declaring our support for the work of Bushra Manahi and the important anti-racism work that she oversees in Montreal, because really there is a racism issue at play here that falls into, you know, political objectives, but really is fundamentally an issue of racism where Palestinian people have been framed in political spheres and in the media for the 75 years of the occupation, certainly, as terrorists and as violent people. And those links between Palestinian resistance and Arab resistance more broadly and what the West conceives of as terrorism are just so there and so tangible that all it takes is a small dog whistle to invoke that image and that understanding of what it means for Palestinian people to stand up for their own rights. So I would say absolutely, it's really devastating to watch politicians use real instances of hate as incitements to backlash against Palestinian people, against Palestinian solidarity work. And also there is a much bigger racist narrative that is getting played on here that I don't even know if Eho's father and others who are using this kind of language are fully aware of the implications of what they're doing.
Can you tell me more about that? Because, you know, the rhetoric around, so Bushra Manahi, her position as the anti-racism commissioner, some in groups like CIJA and the sort of Jewish Montreal establishment are saying that she can't do her job anymore because she has attended these Palestinian solidarity demonstrations or liked or posted things on social media. But, you know, it's these kinds of allegations that are then saying she is not being neutral. And so she can't do her job of looking at racism neutrally. What would you say to that kind of argument?
Yeah, when I saw this story come out of CIJA and B'nai B'rith's attacks on Bushra Manahi and her work, it really made me think that if fighting racism was easy, we wouldn't need a commissioner for it. Like, people tend to see anti-racism work within this kind of EDI, equity, diversity, inclusion lens right now, that it's kind of a like hold hands, easy kind of, you know, education and awareness building exercise. But sometimes fighting racism is really hard and brings up a huge response from the power structures in our country, because there are real economic and political investments in racist policies and practices across the country. We know this is the case, and this is one of those instances where we really see that come to the fore. I think it would be really wonderful if institutions like CIJA and B'nai B'rith would ask themselves why they are pitting themselves against anti-racism appointees. Like, you'd think that there would be, you know, some degree of trust in the system, that there is probably, you know, a lot of experience and knowledge behind someone, you know, being appointed into this kind of a position. And I think we really need to question why they are pitting themselves and, by implication, pitting the Jewish community against people doing anti-racism work at all levels of Canadian government. I think it's ultimately, you know, really damaging, and it has a huge impact on our community's ability to relate to each other. So that's part of the work of repair and relationship building that IJV tries to do, to say that we, you know, the Jewish community in Canada is not all of one mind. And IJV is an organization, we know that our safety is tied together and that there's safety and solidarity. And we are not here to pick fights with anti-racism commissioners.
You've been listening to my conversation with Sarah Boivin from Independent Jewish Voices Montreal. Next on the show, we've got a big announcement from the Mohawk Mothers campaign to hold McGill and the SQI accountable for the work they're doing at the Royal Victoria Hospital site. Take a listen. Hi, do you just mind introducing yourself?
I'm Philippe Louin. I'm an anthropologist, PhD candidate at McGill University, and I've been accompanying the Mohawk mothers throughout this court case for the last 2 years.
Well, thanks for chatting with me. We have a big decision coming in yesterday from Justice Gregory Moore, who's ordering McGill and the Quebec Infrastructure Society, or SQI, to reinstate the expert panel that they had canceled in the summer. This is a victory for the Mohawk mothers after their second court date. Can you tell me more about what exactly they were arguing for at that court date and what this latest decision will mean on the ground at the Royal Victoria Hospital site?
Yes, actually, it was about all the hurdles that the Mohawk mothers had been facing since the settlement agreement was signed last April. These hurdles had to do with problems of communication, for instance, contracts being signed with service providers and with archaeologists without them being reviewed by the Mohawk mothers. Also, on certain points, McGill and the Société Québécoise d'Infrastructure, the SQI, who are responsible for the construction site at the for the new Vic project, they had not been following some of the recommendations of the expert panel of archaeologists, and in fact, they had fired the expert panel in early August. And so that's the decision that Justice Moore, in his interpretation of the settlement agreement, he agreed with the Mohawk mother's view that there was no end date to the panel's implication to oversee on an ongoing basis how the archaeology is done on the mountain.
Yeah, so you're saying that this was a panel not to do the work themselves of, you know, ground penetrating radar or sniffer dogs or any of these technologies we saw at the Royal Victoria Hospital site to check if there were human remains, but instead to oversee that work and to make sure that it was done well. Can you tell me more about why that role of this expert oversight was such an important part of the settlement agreement that Justice Moore decided in favor of the Mohawk mothers in this case?
Yes, actually, it's because, it was the main purpose of the settlement agreement. After months of negotiation that followed the injunction that was obtained last year on October 7th, 2022, it was the spirit of the agreement to have an independent and impartial panel composed of experts who work specifically on searching for unmarked graves and were mindful of the protocol to be respectful to the community and to indigenous protocols related to burial sites, and who actually know what are the best techniques to use and how to implement them. The problem is that the McGill and SQI, at some point in August, decided to themselves manage the service providers who were executing the techniques, ground penetrating radar, and the actual archaeological excavations on the site, and they made it that these service providers were under non-disclosure agreements with them. And there wasn't any third party; they were directly hired by McGill and SQI. So Mohawk mothers were completely pushed aside since last August. So Justice Moore's judgment now acknowledges that the spirit of the agreement was to rely on an independent panel composed of experts, that they are the best placed to determine the course of action on an ongoing basis as well, because things change on the ground. A discovery can lead to other discoveries. And so it's also the spirit of this notion of allowing experts that were jointly selected, these three experts in the panel by all the parties, was also to make sure that the results of the investigation would be trusted by the community, that they're done by people who are not in conflict of interest. So, yeah, that was the spirit that Justice Moore acknowledged in his judgment.
So this is the second court date for the Mohawk mothers or Gunnison Sera this fall. We saw the first one back in September. That was a request for an injunction to halt drilling that was denied. This second court date took place end of October. We're just now hearing the results towards the end of November. It's been a long struggle. How are they feeling right now? What's the mood like among the Mohawk mothers upon hearing this news?
Well, very, very happy and reassured. This was a cause of great stress amongst the Gunnison Sera and Indigenous community members because of the way that the investigation was being done. There was barely any information that filtrated through the searches, and it tended to be conflictual, and there was hardships, emotional stress that now hopefully will be resolved, because these experts on the panel are people that can be trusted for the work that they're doing elsewhere in Indian residential schools throughout Canada. So it's a time for celebration, really, I'd say, with the Mohawk mothers, and great relief that this work that they've done without any legal representation. It's important to mention they have no lawyers, and they're facing very big institutions, McGill, Quebec, Canada, and the city of Montreal. So with many resources that are on the other side, but the Mohawk mothers managed with their little team to put forth their own information and their own understanding, and they're really happy that that the judge understood what was going on.
All right. Well, Philippe Blouin, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Phone Doc, and this mess stinking. When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the chalet, we chilling out here in Montreal on CKUT. Nobody do it better, dog. 90.3 FM. Gone.
You've been listening to my conversation with Philippe Blouin about the Mohawk mother's recent Quebec Superior Court victory that allows an expert panel to be reinstated to monitor the work at the Royal Victoria Hospital site. I contacted McGill, but they're still looking into the decision, they say, so didn't really have much of a comment yet. All right, we are almost at the end of our hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm going to close out the show with the rest of the interview that I did with Ted Rutland, a Concordia professor who studies policing, and especially in Montreal. His comments were part of our policing story earlier on the program, but we really got into the whole political incentive structure around supporting policing for politicians in Montreal, and why alternatives to policing might actually be better for public safety. Here's that conversation.
So my name is Ted Rutland. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geography, Planning, and Environment at Concordia University.
Thank you so much for coming to talk with me today. Let's talk about the budget increase we saw for police. $35 million of additional funding from last year for police. Can you tell me a little bit about how this latest budget increase falls in line with what we've been seeing the last few years from the Paul G. Montréal administration?
Yeah, so since 2020, the Projet Montréal government has increased the police budget by more than any other large city in Canada. They passed a record budget increase for 2022. They set a new record for 2023. This latest budget increase of $35 million is smaller than the last 2 years, but it's still in, you know, probably the third largest budget increase in the city's history. And, you know, it's useful to think about these budget increases in relation to 2020, because that was the moment of the second wave of the Black Lives Matter movement. It was a time where defunding the police, reinvesting in communities, and reimagining public safety was on everyone's lips, where a majority of Canadians supported defunding the police, and where defunding the police came to be synonymous with Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, if we want to look at the record of Projet Montréal since 2020, it's not hard to conclude that Black lives don't matter to them. which no one who's paying attention is surprised about that. It's a white gentrifier party. The police benefit them. The police fit into their vision of kind of bringing a suburban kind of culture to the city where, like, you should not ever have to feel uncomfortable. I mean, that's the ideology of the suburbs. They're bringing that to the city. And so, you know, safety is a really important thing, but we're not talking about safety here. We're talking about making privileged people feel comfortable at all times. And so an unhoused person on the corner is a problem because that might make someone feel uncomfortable. Three Black teenagers on the corner are going to make what certain white people feel uncomfortable. So that's a problem. And so they've just been throwing money at the police. And it's perfectly consistent with their kind of vision for the city, which is just to gentrify everything.
Yeah. Why is Montreal such an outlier? Do you have any ideas or, you know, has your research shown anything that we do differently that, you know, allows the police to operate with, it sounds like, financial impunity, if not, you know, other kinds of impunity that we see when police watchdog investigations in Quebec go nowhere, yield no charges for officers?
Montreal is one of the only large cities that has political parties. The other is Vancouver, but I'll explain why that's different in a second. And so we are stuck right now with Ensemble Montréal, a conservative suburban party, and Projet Montréal, a liberal urban party. And there's no other people who can speak out about this. We have a couple of independent councillors who I'm hoping will say something this year. But Projet Montréal basically squats the center right to the left of the political spectrum. You know, people who are progressive tend to vote for them, even though they're not a progressive party. But there are no progressive people in the party anymore. They've all left because they were silenced. And so the condition of being part of the party is that you follow the party line. You don't speak about this. In a city like Toronto, which is not better in many ways, no, there are no formal political parties. So you're always going to have some city councillors who are going to call attention to this. And then the mayor or whoever has to respond. But here, like, the Ensemble Montréal isn't going to call Projet Montréal to better oversee the police. And no one within Projet Montréal can do it. So it's just, and then the media don't do the work of looking into this because the politicians aren't talking about it. And so we're stuck with this situation that continues from year to year. The reason I said Vancouver also has political parties is they have a few political parties, and one of them is a left-wing party, COPE. They've often had, you know, Jean Swanson is an amazing city councillor who has been in City Hall for years. And so even though they also have political parties, they do have a left-wing political party, which we do not have in Montreal. So that accounts for like a little bit more of their ability to have progressive policies around public safety.
Yeah, though, as you say, Ensemble Montréal, now that they're in opposition, are throwing out some motions that seem to almost just be pointing out the lack of progressive policies within Projet Montréal. Like you mentioned, the doubling of the homelessness budget. It's debatable whether this kind of approach is really something that's at the heart of Ensemble Montréal's politics, but, you know, they seem to be throwing out quite a few motions that are like this, that are kind of oddly pressuring Projet Montréal to put its money where its mouth is. But I'm curious about, you know, you said that the $35 million we're seeing this year isn't even the biggest increase we've seen in the last few years, that it's been massive increases year after year. Is that specifically a response to the events of 2020 with Black Lives Matter, the protests over George Floyd? Like, is that why we're seeing so much money for the police, or is that kind of, is there something else at work? Because it's hard to understand why they would set these record-breaking budget increases at a time when people were, yeah, calling for a diversion of those services to other intervention teams or forms of public safety.
So it was probably a month or 2 months after the first big protests in June 2020 that the Montreal Police, the Montreal Police Brotherhood, the so-called police union, as well as police forces and police brotherhoods across Canada, started to wage a counteroffensive to the Black Lives Matter movement, to the Defund the Police movement. And their first message was, of course we want to do prevention. Of course we want, you know, social services. We need more investment in all these programs, everything that Black Lives Matter is asking for, but you don't have to defund the police. And so that was the message across Canada in the early days of 2020. And then a couple of months later, basically across Canada, all the police forces and police brotherhoods also developed an argument about why we needed more police to respond to particular kinds of crime or quote unquote disorder. And so in Vancouver, it was unhoused people and drug users. In Toronto, it was security on the subway system. In Montreal, it was gun violence. And then, you know, a month later, they sort of revealed that what they really mean is gang violence, which is their code word for Black people. And the Montreal police have been able to use the fear of gangs since 1989. Whenever there's a large protest against police racism or violence, they say that we need more resources to combat gangs. And it doesn't sound like a racist thing to say gangs, but gang is a synonym for Black youth or Black young adult in Montreal. And so they're basically saying we need money to go after those Black criminals, but they don't have to say it because they can just use the word gang. And that's what they've done for 3 years. And, you know, I think that the police and police brotherhoods would have fought for more money anyway, because there's all kinds of social disruptions that came with the COVID pandemic. And so there's more homelessness, there is more violence, you know, there's more gun violence, but there's also more domestic violence. Like, our society got ruptured in various kinds of ways. And so there was more of the things that the police typically campaign on to get more power, to get more money. So I think they would have done this anyway, but certainly they were also doing it as a way of pushing back against the Defund the Police movement.
What would you say to those people to sort of break through that a little bit? Because I think it's tough for people who say, you know, we need to advocate for homeless people on our streets. We need to pay attention to how racialized Montrealers are still being targeted disproportionately by police and stopped by police. You know, it can be hard to say that to people who are experiencing maybe more disruptions, seeing more people in distress post-COVID and just want to feel comfortable.
Yeah, no, I mean, everyone wants to feel comfortable, right? And the thing about living in a city is you're never going to feel comfortable all the time. That's like, that is what it means to live in a city versus a suburb, you know? And I'm generalizing here, but that's been the idea of the city, you know, going back hundreds of years as a space of encounter. Everything that exists in the society is in the city. We see it every day. And to me, that also means that it's a worldly space. You know, we encounter people who come from all over the world, who speak different languages, who bring different cultures and political traditions with them. And that's, you know, that's what's wonderful about a city. And so the tragic thing about Projet Montréal is they're this city of, there's this party of urbanism, but what they're trying to promote really is a very bland, pacified, controlled, suburban lifestyle in the city. And so I think that one thing is just to reconnect people with what cities are all about, and recognize that there's a huge benefit to being in a place that is diverse, that isn't totally controlled. But then I would say also, policing unhoused people doesn't make that sense of insecurity go away. Like, the police themselves will tell you, like, they don't like policing unhoused people for the most part because they know it doesn't do anything. You're kicking someone out of one park. They don't have anywhere to go, so they're going to go somewhere else. And then someone will complain about that person over there, and then now the police have to go and move that person again. Like, they don't even want to do this work for the most part. Some cops are psychotic and they like love terrorizing unhoused people, but for the most part, they actually believe in their work and believe that the police are there to keep people safe, and they know that this doesn't do it. So I would just say that, you know, when we call for defunding the police, we're not calling for more feelings of unsafety. We're calling for more real safety by actually addressing things through care and support rather than pointless punishment. So we could be housing people, you know, it would cost far less to house every unhoused person than to police them all year. And then everybody benefits, you know?
That was Concordia University Associate Professor Ted Rutland talking about policing in Montreal.
And this is also the end of our show. We're coming right up on 6 o'clock. You've been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. As always, if you want to hear one of our stories, you can head to ckut.ca/LJI. My name is Jules Bijal. Thanks so much for listening.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Black, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show every other week on Tuesdays between 6 and 7 p.m. To get involved with Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means.
Do you?
It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum,